Write that down for me, Saito. Write that down for me, Saito.
Hi, everyone. Hello from Burbank, California. Thank you for joining us once again. Another episode of Write That Down on the Fight Game Media Network. My name is Justin Nipper. I work over at fightgamemedia.com, staff writer at F4W Online and WrestlingObserver.com. I work at Pro Wrestling NOAH and CyberFight as well. And again, I am back with Japan's leading pro wrestling author and historian, broadcast journalist, sociologist, wonderful man, Mr. Fumi Saito. We're back with part two of Riki Dozan, father of pro wrestling. This week we cover from 1958, Luthez, onwards to the end of his career. We covered his matches with Fred Blassie. We covered his matches with Destroyer. We talked about Masahiko Kimura some more. And we also debunked lots of wild conspiracies about his death. And there are quite a few. So I was happy to help clear that up with Fumi-san. Thank you for joining us once again. If you have not already, please subscribe to the Fight Game Media Network podcast feed on Spotify or Apple or wherever you usually listen to your podcasts. It helps us very much, so thank you very much. Hope you enjoy. We can do this on part two. So, picking up where we left off last week, we talked about the year 1958. We talked about the year that Riki Dozan finally beat Luthez.
Yeah, and 1958.
Summer. In Los Angeles at the Olympic Auditorium.
Yeah.
So from there, let's talk about the rest of Riki Dozan's career and how it kind of went up and out.
This international heavyweight title is very important. It really represent how he created his Riki Dozan legacy story. You would think if you beat Luthez for the world title, wouldn't you videotape it or film it?
Sure.
Because he had, you know, previously had like a world tour on, you know, the color film, even that he went to Hawaii and that he's getting off a plane and all everything's filmed, that he traveled to New York and bought a car like Chrysler and not quite Porsche yet, but the American made big car, and he's driving across the continent and everything is filmed, you know what I'm saying?
And he had the nice suit on and he's waving to the fans, and I think he even went to
like
visit
a hero's movie, right?
Yeah.
If you were scheduled to beat Luthez in famous Olympic Auditorium, you would think you'll film the entire match, right?
Hmm.
So he, Riki Dozan, in hindsight, he knew that it was going to be controversy. You know what I'm saying?
Mm-hmm.
And in Japan, it was reported that he beat Luthez for the world title, and the UPI and the AP and all these newswire, you know, all over. International newswire outside of wrestling that Riki Dozan beat Luthez, and all the sports pages beat, you know, reported that Riki Dozan finally beat Luthez for the world title. Then UPI said it was non-title, it wasn't even main event. You know what I'm saying?
It's very similar. It sounds just to me, it sounds like Fujinami and Ric Flair in the 90s.
And Inoki against Bob Backlund in 79.
Sure. Yeah. And I think that was sort of, I don't want to say benefit.
Came
but
after
that
this?
It was the time where you could really just, promoters could make decisions and information and travel
and
the way it did.
Manipulate the audience and manipulate the media and manipulate the outcome and the whole story as a whole, right?
Mm-hmm.
But at the time, actually, Luthez, I'm talking about August of 1958, Luthez was not even National Wrestling Alliance World Heavyweight Champion.
Mm-hmm.
NWA champion at the time was Dick Hutton. Then this, you know, NWA world title goes from Dick Hutton to Pat O'Connor, and from Pat O'Connor to Buddy Rogers. It goes, you know, from Buddy Rogers goes back to Luthez. But you have to wait to like a, you know, a couple years. And it was a time that Luthez actually was taking time off from this crazy NWA world title, traveling world champion schedules, right? And but at the same time, whenever Luthes appeared, like making special appearance here and there, Arizona, that the New Mexico, Albuquerque, the Los Angeles, or sometimes Columbus, or, you know, Ohio, Detroit, that Luthes was always billed as international champion, you know, like his nickname,
right?
While he was not having NWA world title. Mm-hmm. So in a way, international heavyweight title existed, but not quite sanctioned by NWA. Mm-hmm. Then again, it wasn't all that important in Japan that the beating Luthes in America and Riki Dozan became champion. It's not far from the truth, right? Mm-hmm. And the third, you know, it's like a difference, you know, different kind of result in the third fall. See, at the time, all through 50s and early 60s into 70s, maybe, that the title match was 2 out of 3 fall match, huh?
Yeah, that was the norm all over the world.
Yeah. And the third fall was DQ finish. Mm. Therefore, technically, probably if it was even the title match, title wouldn't change hand, huh?
That's right. But it would also make sure that both guys came out of there not looking
like
too
winner.
Weak. Yeah, like they kind of won. They didn't lose. Yeah, right. They didn't lose. That's the idea.
And this is wrestling, you know?
Sure.
And some results say that the Riki Dozan beat Luthes with count out, you know, outside the ring. And some result will state that it was DQ. And some result in Japanese sports page simply said that Riki Dozan beat Luthes with his famous karate chop. Hmm. So it's confusing. And upon Riki Dozan's return, you know, to Haneda Airport, you know, all the reporters and newspapers and photographers all gathered and waiting for, you know, Riki Dozan to come out, right? Mm-hmm. And Riki Dozan, of course, have that mini press conference right there at the airport, right? I beat Luthes for the world title. That's how I understand. I don't know about the UP. Somebody already fed the information that some of the news wires said it was not even a title match. And all in all, Riki Dozan didn't win anything. But Riki Dozan insisted that I beat Luthes and became world champion. And do you have a belt? And he said, no, I don't have the physical belt because it's Luthes' belonging. Oh, okay. And the fact is that I'm a champion, but I'm going to make my own championship belt, which he did, you know, later on, that the International Heavyweight Championship belt that looked exactly like Luthes' belt. Mm-hmm. And also this International Heavyweight title story came on wrestling magazines, like this International Heavyweight title goes back to George Hackenschmidt, goes back to 1908 or something like that, you know. And the second champion was Antonino Rocca in New York because he was an international superstar. And Luthes, as big as he was, had two sets of championship belt. The one is World Heavyweight Championship sanctioned by National Wrestling Alliance, NWA. And the other was awarded to him because he traveled the world. And he's an international champion. And that international championship was the one Riki Dozan beat for. Mm-hmm. Pretty good story, huh? But anyhow, that the origin of the title was such, but Riki Dozan started defending his, you know, very first, very important world title, like international, you know, well, that is to confuse people. Sometimes it was called World Heavyweight Champion. Sometimes it was called International Heavyweight Champion. And the world and international was pretty much one in the same, you know, in the one paragraph they used, you know, in a newspaper article, in the one paragraph, they used both names. That was a world title. That was international heavyweight title. And this, people think it's one in the same. Anyhow, he started defending his international title and stayed in Japan for the remainder of his career. So International Heavyweight Championship became the most important title in Japan. But that's, you know, that's a fact. Does that make sense? Hello.
Can you hear me? Yeah, it's a title that served its purpose when it needed to. It's a title that was whenever you could kind of, and it was the time period where you could tell a story, and that's all you needed was a background
also,
for it.
Also, Ricky Dozan didn't want that to be, you know, Japan heavyweight title or Asian heavyweight title or Pacific Coast heavyweight title or anything like that. It had to be world title, or it's called international championship.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So for a native English speaker, the world champion and the international champion, which sound better? About the same?
Well, to a wrestling fan, I guess you'd have to say world, just because we've all been trained to accept
trained and conditioned.
The world is number one, and international or intercontinental, that seems a step down for some reason. Although the main difference is that world is a noun and international is an adjective. It's a way to describe a noun.
So, right, yeah.
They mean it's the same idea, though. It's the internet and
the
world.
Yeah, it's the same idea. And to make this argument even harder was that we just talked about 1908, right? Mm. There was a two title match, 1908 and 1911, both time Frank Gotch of America against George Hackenschmidt of Russia, right? To unify an undisputed world heavyweight title. It was called International Championship. Confusing, huh?
But it sounds good, so.
Yeah, yeah. Anyhow, so international heavyweight title became the focal point of, you know, Japan Pro Wrestling Association and Ricky Dozan's all this 10-year legacy, and he defended his title against people like, you know, Jesse Ortega, that Haystacks Calhoun, the Sonny Myers, the Pat O'Connor, the young Don Leo Jonathan, there's all these superstars from America. And that the International Heavyweight Championship became the main thing in Japanese ring. And also, he started World League.
That's right.
Spring annual tournament, you know, from like a 10 superstars from America every spring, come in for like an 8-week period and have this, you know. Actually, it wasn't even, it's a tournament, but it was not a round robin. If it was a round robin tournament, Japanese against Japanese will happen, right? It didn't happen. It was always Japanese wrestler against American wrestler, and sometimes American against American. It was just like, well, it didn't make perfect sense. But during this 6 to 8 week period, they go through this championship match and compete in points, you know, and the first annual World League tournament in 1959, the following year, you know, people like Lord James Blair's, that Mr. Atomic is a, you know, very first mask guy who came to Japan. It's probably not a politically correct now, huh? Because Mr. Atomic in Japan, oh my gosh, right?
Yeah.
Post-war period.
A little on the nose, I guess you could say, but.
Yeah, it's like a very close call, you know?
Wrestling featured that sort of vocabulary that we don't use these days. Because...
Right, right. But Mr. Atomic instead became really popular because he looked like a TV character, like Gekko Kamen, that, you know, your masked hero that the Japanese TV loves so much.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, so Mr. Atomic, Jesse Ortega, and Nicky Torres from America, from California, Lord James Blair's from England, and all these famous wrestlers came and competed in tournament, and Ricky Dozan beat Mighty Osos, Jesse Ortega, for the final, and became the first World League champion in 1959. So it's like a tournament champion and international champion. Yeah.
Yeah, you could really believe he was the real deal. I guess that was the...
Oh, it's he's been the real deal, but the more like, it's like when they started, you know, well, we have to rewind the tape a little bit because, you know, for people who probably didn't listen to our, you know, part one episode, that Ricky Dozan's wrestling started, you know, officially started, that the beginning of television was the beginning of wrestling, and beginning of wrestling was the beginning of television, and it was 1954 that Ricky Dozan and King of Judo Masahiko Kimura made a special tag team when I went up against the famous Sharp brothers, Ben Sharp and Mike Sharp. And it was San Francisco's world tag team title, but it was just simply called world tag team title, you know, like a wrestling, you know, American style professional wrestling was introduced in Japanese market as a tag team match. Wouldn't you think 101 would be bigger? You know, like a Japanese, you know, martial arts background, kendo da, jujitsu da, judo da, karate da. It's always 101, right? Or even in boxing, there's no tag team match. But the wrestling was introduced as a tag team.
Was there any reason behind that? Was there a specific reason behind that? Or it was just because...
I think Rick Dozan was a great producer and great wrestling mind that he wanted to introduce professional wrestling as he studied in America. You know, that in single match situation, there's going to be a winner and loser, huh? And he was so smart as a producer that he did not want to win that kind of, you know, like a initial world championship in his TV debut. It had to be the long drama chasing the world, right?
Mm.
Yeah. And also tag team situation will introduce you what the professional wrestling is about. A tag in, tag out, or doing things behind referee's back, or the not just the straight wrestling, but there's a showmanship in it, and there's a little bit of laughter in it, and the heat in wrestling term. It's like whole drama was introduced with tag team wrestling. Does that make sense?
Yeah, you could introduce a lot of the elements of pro wrestling in one match. You wouldn't have to do it over a series of singles matches over months or
and
years.
And also, single match gets way too serious right away. It was like more like post-war period that the, you know, Japanese hero will go up against American, like a, not the hero, but the villain, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And, well, actually, the Sharp brothers are from Canada, not even American, but introduced as a big gaijin, right? And, yeah. And also, time situation, Ricky Dozan did not lose. It was always Masahiko Kimura who took the fall. So smart, right? Because it was within, you know, like a people's mind, a former sumo wrestler star Ricky Dozan and king of judo Masahiko Kimura trying new thing, American style professional wrestling. But in people's mind, Kimura is a little bit more legitimate, you know, because for the 13-year period, he never once lost judo match. You know, Ricky Dozan was a sekiwake, not even ozeki, not even yokozuna. You know, he was a senior class, top, you know, top sumo star, but he wasn't quite grand champion star, you know. And but it was Ricky Dozan's program, you know. Ricky Dozan's a promoter. Ricky Dozan was a producer, and he really packaged this tag team, American style professional wrestling real well with Sharp Brothers. Sharp Brothers tag team expert knew what they were doing, and they can be, you know, subtle heel, they can be a big, you know, follow the rule babyface type wrestling. They were like the master of the craft. And Ricky Dozan actually met Sharp Brothers in San Francisco the previous year, and he knew that it took Sharp Brothers craft to introduce American style professional wrestling to Japanese TV, therefore Japanese market. And little did Kimura know, huh? You know, because he actually, Kimura, you know, Masahiko Kimura, the judo master, became professional wrestler in Hawaii 1 year before Ricky Dozan, actually. Mm-hmm. A year before Ricky Dozan. And he went to Hawaii after this you know, that failed attempt of professional judo in 1950. See, there was a group of Kodokan judo people who wanted to become professional and run like a professional judo, international judo association, like a pro wrestling, and wanted to run the show for money. But the people weren't ready to have professional judo as your sport entertainment. And also, Ricky Dozan was a much bigger star, like star aura, you know, the way you know, carry yourself as a star. And all in all, Masahiko Kimura and his people and the one who started professional judo was, his name was Tatsukuma Ushijima, eighth degree judoka, you know, black belt judoka. You know, post-war period, they wanted to make judo professional and ran the show, but really failed. Mm-hmm. And Kokichi Endo and other judoka and Masahiko Kimura went to Hawaii to do the judo exhibition, ended up becoming professional wrestler. Like, that's not exactly what he wanted to do, but the promoter who invited Kimura and other judoka was that they were wrestling promoters. They were going to make them pro wrestlers, you know. And Kimura just didn't, I mean, he was always amateur in a way, don't you think?
Yeah, judo, the way it was, I mean, yeah, it was, you're right, it was presented around the same time as pro wrestling. They didn't develop with each other, but there was a period of time where they were almost side by side, but not just in Japan, but places like Brazil. They were trying to do these
and also
big
it
shows.
Was 1950, yeah, and also he traveled, you know, to mainland states and Mexico and Central America, and finally Brazil. It was 1955 that the Kimura had the famous fight against Elio Gracie, Gracie. Yeah, and basically, it's almost controversy too, because he had this Kimura, you know, Kimura lock on, but the Elio never gave up. Somebody threw a towel in, the Gracie family. And Elio Gracie himself didn't really tap out. So it was like Kimura beat him, but didn't really defeat him, kind of thing.
Yeah, there were also lots of issues with the Gracies and wanting specific kinds of rules that were not quite judo,
right.
Their own jujitsu. I don't think any of it, what it did was it helped the sportsmen, helped the people doing judo and jiu-jitsu, but it didn't really appeal to fans. None of it did.
Right. And also for judo, judo did not become international sport until 1968 Olympic,
mm-hmm.
You know, because it became Olympic official, in the sport, that people started taking on judo, you know, in the whole world. You know, now it's an international Olympic sport, but judo was staying in Japan and pretty much within Japan until like 1950s.
Hmm.
And Kimura was product of the time. Of course, he was a king of judo, but he wasn't making money other than being instructor and sensei, right?
Hmm.
And that professional judo thing really didn't make it, and he was invited by promoters in Hawaii to be an judo instructor and also have judo exhibition in wrestling ring, and ended up becoming professional wrestler almost without knowing it. Anyhow, so the thing was, Kimura became professional wrestler 1 year before Riki Dozan. They learned professional wrestling in two different places. Riki Dozan met other people and became professional wrestler, and yeah, so it was like former judoka and former sumo wrestler both taking on this new introduction of American professional wrestling, like a new sport, post-war sport. And there was an argument, is that a sport or an entertainment? It always was there, that the issue was there. But anyhow, that the very first televised match, Riki Dozan and Masahiko Kimura got together and made a tag team, and went against Sharp Brothers. That was the beginning of the television and the beginning of wrestling. And I guess Rick Dawson pretty much outsmarted, you know, Kimura, huh? And Kimura, in situation in a tag team match, he was the one taking pinfalls. Yeah. Then there was that year in December that through the newspaper, Kimura challenged Rick Dawson for a real fight, you know. He's a showman, and in the real fight situation, no way Riki Dozan can beat me.
Right, that's what he said. That was the big, that was the line that kind of riled Riki Dozan up.
Yeah, but I think that the deal was already made when they announced it. Mm-hmm. It's wrestling, you know,
right.
And it was going to be a big draw, you know, no conclusion, and 20 years after that match took place, you know, in 1983 or so, and Masahiko Kimura finally answered the magazine interview saying that it was going to be a draw, And after that, the Tokyo first match, we were going around the horn and we were going to travel around Japan, like Osaka, the Nagoya, the Hiroshima, the all over country to have the same single match, and we were going to make money. That never happened. It's like, wow, that's wrestling, isn't it? Mm-hmm.
But very much.
Kimura himself was never a professional wrestler in mind. He was the judoka who happened to be doing some wrestling. How's that?
You know, when you put it that way and you think about the whole canon of current Japanese pro wrestling, there are, to me, there seem to be in Japan two general types of pro wrestlers, and ones who are more wrestler-centric, who have a background
and grew up as a wrestling fan.
Or wrestlers who, like Kimura, Akira Maeda, Naoya Ogawa, even Satoru Sayama, and people incorporating real martial arts and embrace, or Shinya Hashimoto's to an extent, embracing Budo.
Grew up as a big wrestling fan.
He did, but he wasn't, when you think of him, you don't think of Olympic athlete or wrestler, you think of Shinya Hashimoto. And I think there is definitely there's a separation. There are two types of root wrestlers. There are wrestlers, and there are wrestlers who got their start in martial arts first. And I think we could see that split early on.
Break down into smaller groups too.
Of course, it's very general. It's very general.
Yeah, because smaller group within that is that Shinya Hashimoto was really wrestling fan. He never had problem doing professional wrestling with finishes, you know what I'm saying?
Oh, right. So he's not somebody, you can't compare him to somebody like Akira Maeda, who had a different philosophy on how things should go. Hashimoto was a wrestler.
True, but more like an alien, like a space alien, like, you know, who just happened to wander into wrestling world, like former Yokozuna Kitao, mm-hmm, or Naoya, mm-hmm, Ogawa.
Sure.
You know, because they were never even wrestling fan, and they didn't want to lose.
And you sense that tension from them every time.
Yeah, yeah. So it's like there was a trust issue there, you know? If you're a professional wrestler and wrestler is wrestler, you trust your camaraderies. They're all, you know, you're a professional wrestler. You don't injure yourself, you don't injure others. You know what I'm saying?
Mm. Mm.
And for Kitao or today's, you know, Naoya Ogawa probably, and back then Kimura, I think winning and losing was everything because that's how they grew up.
Mm.
And they had problem with that, you know, that the Rikido isn't going over or something. But anyhow, that it was said it was going to be a draw, and instead, the match took place in December, Riki Dozan against Kimura. As history shows, that Riki Dozan basically beat him, you know, to his home.
He beat the shit out of him. I mean, in not a pro wrestling way, in a barroom brawl kind of way.
Like a kick in the face and stuff.
Just a toe to the face.
But he was like carefully, you know, laid out too, because right before that, the video footage almost justifies that they were saying that the Kimura kicked Riki Dozan in groin, and then Riki Dozan got angry or something. That the story goes, you know what I'm saying? Hmm. But that video footage really somewhat shows that, right, Kimura's kicking Riki Dozan in the middle, and, you know, that seconds later, Riki Dozan, his face changes and start, you know, giving this, you know, karate thrust and a big, you know, like a palm thrust into the face. And I think
there was just a straight fist to the face too from
yeah, after that, yeah.
And closed and fist.
With this Kimura's background, he just sensed that right away. It's like something's definitely wrong, right? So he just, I think he decided to lay there too, because if you get knocked out, you go backward and, you know, the face up, right?
Mm.
But this time, Kimura's face was down. He's like, no, I ain't doing this anymore. You know what I'm saying?
There was one shot that drops him whether it was worked or not, I don't know, but it was a shot. I know what you mean. I thought the same. Maybe he was just playing dead, so Riki Dozan would stop. But
Yeah, but his face was actually swollen up too, so that the contact was made. Yeah, so it's like that's like 60-year mystery that we can spend all night talking about this. But it was what happened, and with this one match, that made Riki Dozan the king of this professional wrestling industry. And after that, Kimura didn't really spend much time with wrestling. Although he ran some of his own shows though with Mexican, masked wrestlers, then he went to Europe and went to Mexico and he did some wrestling for money, but eventually Kimura came back to Japan and went back to Takshoku University and became judo coach, and that's what he did the rest of his life. He only wrestled what, total of 4 years, 3 years, 4 years, but the Riki Dozan's legacy just begun right there, you know what I'm saying? Yeah, but anyhow, that fast forward a little bit, 1950, summer of 1958 in Los Angeles, without filming it, just still photos that as evident, Riki Dozan beat Luthes for the international title, and the international title in Japan was created, and he stayed in Japan. It's still part of All Japan's Triple Crown 7 years later. And following year, 1959, the World League tournament starts. 59, 60, 61, 63, 62, 63. So 5 year period. That was the main thing until his death. Spring tournament. This spring tournament tradition remains with All Japan's, today's All Japan, or Giant Baba's All Japan's Champion Carnival. And Antonio Inoki's New Japan Pro Wrestling first 5 years at the Madison Square Garden series, all kinds of New York superstar from WWF, that the partnership with Vince McMahon Sr., that New Japan had Madison Square Garden series for spring tournament, and it became IWGP tournament before IWGP became heavyweight title to be defended, that it was spring tournament thing. Then in December you have tradition of tag team tournament thing, right? Yeah, so that the calendar year was created back then.
And I mean, you could even trace it back today to something like the G1, or again, the All Japan,
Summer
this
tournament, yeah.
All Japan's version of Champion Carnival, N1, or women's have it with Stardom's Grand Prix.
Grand, yeah, right.
That's a
Five
just
star Grand Prix tournament, yeah.
it's the template. It's the foundation for how
Yeah,
Japanese
tournament
wrestling
easy to
is usually
understand, and
scheduled.
also for this 4 or 5 year, 5 week, 6 year, 6 weeks period that everybody have single match with one another. It's very interesting, right?
Like a dream match feeling.
Yeah. So 59, he beat Jesse Ortega to win the championship. Following year, he beat Leon Armellini for the final, which is good because like a former 49ers football player.
Big
Leon
guy.
Armellini, yeah. Leon Armellini was the one, one of the wrestlers Riki Dozan lost during his stay in America. Between 53 to 54, 1 year period, Riki Dozan spent one whole year in America learning business, right? To be a promoter, to be a superstar, to be a TV producer, and whole bit. That the three wrestlers reportedly he lost, was Leon Armellini and Red Scorpion Tom Rice and Fred Atkins, three wrestlers. So there was a revenge time that the 1960s World League Tournament final, Riki Dozan finally beat this big football superstar, Leon Armellini. Interesting, huh? And the third annual was a 63, where they had Karl Krauser, that the later on Karl Gotch, right? And Great Antonio. Probably Great Antonio. When you talk about Great Antonio, decades later, Inoki beat the shit out of him, right?
Kind of famous story.
Yeah. But that original, the Great Antonio's original tour was 1961, the third annual World League tournament. And also that the final of the tournament was Riki Dozan against Mr. X, that big, gynecologist, black mask guy. The inside was Dr. Bill Miller, and big superstar from AWA. Anyhow, that the Ricky Dozan beat Mr. X, the big black man, you know, that the dark mask guy, you know, for the final. And Coral Gotch's German suplex was introduced that year. And young 18, 19-year-old, you know, Inoki in ringside being a ring boy, that the witnessing the Coral Gotch's German suplex. Yeah. So that the little bit of history there.
Hmm.
And actually, this 19-year-old Antonio Inoki participated in the World League tournament too, the fourth annual, in 1962. It was Lou Thesz in it, Freddie Blassie in it, Great Togo in it, all kinds of other superstars. The tournament final was once again Ricky Dozan against Lou Thesz. Not the title match, but the tournament final. Ricky Dozan beat Lou Thesz in count out, you know, finish. And that was the last time Ricky Dozan and Lou Thesz ever met.
Hmm.
Fourth annual. Then fifth annual, 1963, was Ricky Dozan against Killer Kowalski final. And he was going to, Ricky Dozan was saying that they were going to do this World League tournament in 5 years. This is it. This was my final. And actually, it became his final. He won fifth annual World League tournament in 1963, spring of 1963, and he died that year. Interesting, huh?
Mm. So it came pretty, I guess you could say, abruptly. Well, of course, abruptly, but also at a high point in his wrestling career. I imagine if Ricky Dozan had been alive, he'd have been a big star for the next at least 10, 15 more years, right?
Probably, but he was already, you know, that the hinting that he is retiring soon. See, in 1963, Ricky Dozan was already like an 11-year veteran, mm-hmm. on top for 10 years. And another thing, you know, you and I talked about, that in 1961, he built the Ricky Sports Palace in Shibuya, in the 9th Street, big, huge building, round building that he designed after that the Honolulu Civic Center, like a round dome-shaped building with 9 stories building with, you know, the sports gym, the wrestling gym, the boxing gym, that the restaurant, nightclub, sauna, and bowling alley in one building. And Ricky Sports Palace was built in 1961. It was going to be, it did become that the home of pro wrestling, and his dream palace, Ricky Sports Palace, was built in 1961. You know, in 1961's money, he spent millions on it, and it was going to be a center of pro wrestling and also dojo. And there was a nightclub and restaurant and sauna and, you know, a bowling alley, of all things. He saw these, you know, multi-purpose building in America and wanted to make something like that. Yeah.
Do you think in today's world, it's kind of the equivalent would be maybe Tokyo Dome City or something like that? With the bowling, yeah. And all the video games and rides and restaurants.
And sauna, spa. Mm. Yeah. And but there was a restaurant and nightclubs in there, and a membership, you know, sports gym.
Mm-hmm. And, yeah, everything.
And 6th floor, 7th floor, 8th floor was like a round-shaped wrestling arena that holds 3,000 people. It's much like Korakuen Hall size, I guess, but that was Ricky Dozan's dream. And following year, around the same time, Ricky Dozan built Ricky Apartment in Akasaka, Tokyo, like you're talking 1960, right? But like today's condominium style, you know, apartment with swimming pool in it. He himself lived there, but he built Ricky Apartment. That was his thing. And also, he started Ricky Cafe, that, you know, like a modern American style restaurant. Yeah. And the following year, he announced that the new company that he's, you know, that the opening for the, it's called Lakeside Country Club, big, huge golf course.
Oh, where was that? Was that in Tokyo or is that outside of
No,
Tokyo?
not like some outside Tokyo. Yeah, like he bought the big
Chiba or
huge land,
something.
or Sagami or somewhere around there. Yeah, that he was going to build this lakeside country club, the membership golf club. I was just building things and things, like going to that direction,
Real
you know.
entrepreneur.
Yeah, the Ricky Dozan's ambition, yeah, shows it. Yeah. So he was, of course, he need to be wrestling superstar though, but see from Ricky Dozan and Kimura Sharp Brothers thing, introduction of wrestling, beginning of wrestling, beginning of television, beginning of television, beginning of wrestling, beat Kimura to be the king of of the industry, and beat King Kong for Asian title, and beat Tom Rice for Pacific title, and following year finally he beat Luthes. It wasn't an NWA world title, but he brought that title as a title, came home as an international champion, and whomever sanctioned at the time, but it became your centerpiece, international heavyweight title in Japan that stayed in Japan. Then World League for the 5 year period. So he, I think this 10 year period, he done it all as a wrestler and wrestling promoter. Yeah. And he was expanding himself to this lakeside country club golf course, the Ricky Sports Palace, the Ricky apartment, the Ricky Cafe, the yeah. So I think he was really moving towards that direction around that time, early 60s.
When was it that he had his match with Destroyer? Was it in the
Okay, I'll get to it. This was another international, like a big, huge, like a, I was gonna say storyline, but now storyline, but the very big program. It was 1962, okay? 1962. March in LA, March 28th to be exact, Los Angeles Olympic Auditorium. He beat Freddie Blassie to become WWA World Heavyweight Champion, Worldwide Wrestling Associates, LA based, another big organization. It was a spin-off of Luthes's belt, actually. Again, starting from like 1957 in Chicago, Edouard Carpentier beat, forfeit, Luthes for NWA title. Then Edouard Carpentier start defending NWA world title all over the company, whereas some parts of the country titles held up. And Luthes still defending his title elsewhere. And up in Montreal, that Luthes and Edouard Carpentier meet again to unify the title. In the meantime, there's in the Boston, the Killer Kowalski beats Edouard Carpentier, and Boston recognized new company Killer Kowalski as a world champion. And other places, this is like a world champion claimant, like few people in well, it's like America and in wrestling markets too big that you can have more than one champion, right? Around the same time, 1960, Pat O'Connor supposedly wouldn't, defend his NWA world title against Vern Gagne. Therefore, Vern Gagne goes ahead and creates his American Wrestling Association, AWA, and becomes his own world champion. And Edouard Carpentier came to LA as a person who beat Luthes. Then Freddie Blassie beat Edouard Carpentier to become WWA world champion. That's what I'm getting to. And Ricky Dozan beats Freddie Blassie to become WWA world champion in March 28th of 1962. And following month, in April 23rd in Tokyo, both Freddie Blassie and Ricky Dozan come back from LA and has Ricky Dozan's very first title defense. Okay. Then the Ricky Dozan beat Freddie Blassie again. World champion, world champion. Then July of that year, July 26, 1962, he goes back to LA and champion Ricky Dozan against challenger Freddie Blassie. That Ricky Dozan was got so bloodied, and the referee stopped the match and awarded the title back to Freddie Blassie. How's that? That was a big program.
Yeah, I mean, those last couple of years, those were big. Yeah, like you said, big programs. And Rick Dozon was even more, becoming even more well known in the States.
Yeah, but what was interesting is though that I saw the program from LA that night, you know, mm-hmm. saying it was the match of century. WWA World Champion Ricky Dozan against NAWA whatever World Champion Freddy Blassie. Both were billed as world champion that night.
Hmm.
Like unifying world title. Not Freddy Blassie being challenger or anything like that. But in Japan, it was reported champion Ricky Dozan against challenger Freddy Blassie. That's it.
Yeah. It's confusing.
And, oh, very confusing. And also, this Ricky Dozan against Freddy Blassie, 1962, March, April, July, this, you know, three city, LA, Tokyo, back to LA, this three big title match, right? It's a big program, huh? Hmm. During that time period, this Ricky Dozan's own international heavyweight title was ignored. Sort of like a, Ricky Dozan didn't really defend his international heavyweight title once that year. It just, you're supposed to forget about it or something, you know?
Sure.
Or make people confused. The real world title was in LA, and Freddy Blassie and Ricky Dozan had a first match in LA, back to Tokyo. Ricky Dozan defended title successfully, then bring the title back to LA and in July, and he referee stopped the match mysteriously that Ricky Dozan was bloody, and that gave the title, you know, championship belt back to Freddy Blassie, and Ricky Dozan's all angry and came home. How's that? You know what I mean?
Pretty dramatic, but at the end, yeah.
Yeah, then the same year, Ricky Dozan starts defending his international title domestically again.
Mm-hmm.
Isn't that interesting?
Hmm.
Yeah, so for 1 year period when they were playing with WWA world title from LA, they treated that as an undisputed world championship, right? And
didn't Ricky Dozan end up buying that belt?
A physical belt?
Hmm.
I don't know, because there's like a photos of, you know, this, you know, Dick Byer Destroyer wearing a Luthes looking belt, and there's like lots of publicity photo that the Freddy Blassie wearing Luthes belt, and this Ricky Dozan was always wearing this Luthes looking belt in Japan too, so there must be more than one physical belt of that design.
It must be, yeah.
And they always treated that as international heavyweight title too. Then when, you know, Jan Baba opened the All Japan Pro Wrestling in 1972, that Momota family came out and gave that belt to Baba. Therefore, that became very first PWF belt, you know.
Mm.
Then they changed the design. But it looks like Ricky Dozan's old belt was just, you know, metal, gold belt, like Luthes design. And I believe there are more than one physical Luthes belt. Like, yeah. And later on, if you remember UWFI Takada from 1996, he was wearing a belt too.
That's right. And Luthes was there to present it.
Right, right. So that design, Luthes belt itself, meant something, like a brand.
I see.
Yeah. But that's another subject for another day. So 1962, Ricky Dozan, Freddy Blassie program was really big. You know, LA, Tokyo, LA, really international flavor, right?
Mm-hmm.
And Ricky Dozan winning the belt, but losing it, not really losing it. I mean, losing it by not being defeated. How's that?
Yes.
Yeah. Yeah. And there's Ricky Dozan's very last famous program against Dick Byer Destroyer. That was actually the best program Ricky Dozan had. And sadly, that was his last program. Yeah. That was 1963. Following year, and his final year, aside from, you know, World League, it was right after fifth annual World League tournament final, Ricky Dozan beating Killer Kowalski for the championship. The Dick Byer Destroyer, the intelligent, sensational Destroyer, right, with white mask, he and suit and tie underneath. He comes into ring and challenges Ricky Dozan the final night of the World League tournament. Then there was like a 1 week tour that the Destroyer comes in as WWA Los Angeles, of course, WWA World Champion, and defending his title against challenger Ricky Dozan that year. What was funny was, though, now you have the record from the States, right?
Mm-hmm.
It was March, May It was May of 1963, the first meeting of between Ricky Dozan and Dick Beyer, the Destroyer, was May 19th of 1963 in Osaka, non-title, okay? And Destroyer beat him, okay? The first meeting. Then May 24th in Tokyo is like another title. That was a WWE title match, champion Destroyer against challenger Ricky Dozan, and it was a draw, okay? Therefore, Ricky Dozan couldn't win the title. But the record shows now that the Destroyer didn't even have the title that day. He dropped the title to I forgot it was either Freddie Blassie or Bob Ellis or somebody, or you know, there was another champion in LA that week. You know what I'm saying? It's not weird. News traveled very slowly that, you know, around the time period in 1963. Dick Beyer Destroyer came to Japan billed as the current WWE champion. But in LA, there was another champion defending the title that week. Mm.
Yeah. That was kind of the norm, or the way you did business.
Wrestling business was.
Yeah, and it was also based on how technology was at the time too, and how we communicated.
Yeah, it was like decades before the internet, of course.
A lot of it, we got. There was TV at the moment, but before that, I mean, it was mostly press. It was mostly print. It was.
Yeah, and the way newswire.
Newswire. So we're getting the stories in a different way. It's completely different. So it's nice to study. Anyhow,
as a champion, Destroyer defended title against Rick Dozen, and it was, you know, 2 out of 3 fall match and 60-minute, you know, Broadway. And the first meeting, you know, in the May of 1963, they had two matches, one win by Destroyer and one draw. So Ricky Dozan didn't win either, okay? Then 6 months later, in December of the same year, 1963, Destroyer came back. It was really rare that the same wrestler traveled to Japan twice in 1 year. Mm. Destroyer was the only one. They brought Destroyer, it was so popular right away, that they brought Destroyer back in December of that same year, and they had this time champion Ricky Dozan, international heavyweight champion. Destroyer was a challenger. And the first meeting, December 24th, Christmas Eve, December 2nd or something, that Ricky Dozan beat Destroyer for the first time. Now it's 1-1, one draw, right? Then 2 days later in Osaka, Texas Deathmatch was brought, you know, they introduced that no pinfall, or just you do it until you can't continue anymore. And that was a draw. December 4th in Osaka. And so they had 4 single matches. Ricky Dozan in the Destroyer had 4 single matches in 1 year. 1 win, 1 lose, 1-1, 2 draw. So it's like for Destroyer or for Ricky Dozan. 1 win, 1 lose, 2 draw in 4 matches. So it was like a to be continued if they didn't, you know, if Ricky Dozan didn't pass. And the same week, I guess, December 7th, 3 days later, the final night of this Destroyer Series tour, 6-man tag team, Ricky Dozan, Michiaki Yoshimura, and Great Togo against Destroyer and Killer Buddy Austin and Ilio De Paolo, 6-man tag team. It happened in Hamamatsu. That was the very last night Ricky Dozan ever wrestled. So Destroyer was his last opponent.
Oh.
Of his life, of Ricky Dozan's life.
You know, I heard a story that Destroyer was supposed to be with Ricky Dozan the night he was...
At the nightclub?
Yeah, but he didn't go.
I think that day he had lunch, you know.
Something like that, yeah.
Yeah, Dick Beyer had lunch... there was the plan that the sumo, you know, not the professional wrestling, but this sumo association was going to have a U.S. tour following year. Mm-hmm. And Dick Buyer Destroyer was going to be the representative in the States. And Sumo People and Ricky Dozan and Dick Buyer had lunch together that day, like hours before his stabbing incident.
Mm-hmm.
So Dick Buyer stayed a little longer that day. He could have gone to the Latin Quarter where the incident happened.
Mm.
Yeah. But that shows to you that Dick Buyer and Ricky Dozan became good friends.
That's right.
Yeah.
He made a lot of money.
And also Dick Buyer really started having feeling about like Japan, like, you know, the place he wants to be, you know?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So he could have been in that nightclub, New Latin Quarter in Akasaka, where stabbing incident really happened that night later on. Yeah, that's all ifs, you know.
A lot of, yeah, there's so much mystery around Riki Dozan's death.
Oh, so much mystery. And this, the night of December 8th at the Akasaka nightclub, New Latin Quarter, he was stabbed by, his name is Murata, but that's not important. But he was stabbed in the bathroom fight. Who stepped the toe? No, I didn't step your toe, and you stepped my toe, and this is a push and shove. And from all account, Ricky Dozan beat him up in the bathroom, mm-hmm. right? And that this little Yakuza guy, that the low class mafia guy, felt danger of his life, I guess. And he had a little knife, 13 centimeter knife. That's like, what would that be? 4-inch knife?
13 centimeters. Sorry, my American brain has to do some calculations.
5-inch, probably?
Yeah, like about 5
Not
inches.
Not that big of a knife.
A little bit more. Yeah, 5 inches.
Yeah. Yeah, from his pocket. Who would have knife in his suit pocket, right?
Hmm.
Yeah. But he stabbed Ricky Dozan. Then he ran, okay? Ricky Dozan stood up and came back to the table where he was drinking and kept drinking. And he went up to stage, Ricky Dozan himself went up to stage where live bands were playing and grabbed the house mic and said, there's a gang in this house. Please be careful, people. I got stabbed, right? And he went back to the table where he was drinking with his friend's entourage that he kept drinking. Then his friend looked at his, you know, side, like a stomach. He's like, sir, you're bleeding. You know, we got to call ambulance. He said, no, don't, whatever you do, don't call ambulance or people will know, right? And the Ricky Dozan wouldn't be stabbed, you know. Then he kept drinking a little more. Then it was, sir, you're bleeding. I'll take you home. Then he went home that night, like 11 o'clock at night, then called the ambulance, then had a stitched, you know. Then had an infection a little bit. He went back to hospital the next day again. Then he was in hospital the remainder of time. Yeah. He wouldn't die until a week later, though. The stabbing incident happened in December 8th. He died on 15th of December. So he was in hospital for one whole week. I mean, as a record. Yeah. Because there's a story, you know, you and I talked about that, you know, somebody's, you know, the podcast that a lot of the famous story was that he was stabbed by urinated knife and he was poisoned, right?
Yeah, and he died of an infection or something.
Not true. Yeah. And also there's a crazy story in some podcast that Ricky Dozan had a $2 million in cash in U.S. currency in his briefcase. He handcuffed himself with his briefcase. Mafia guy followed him in the bathroom and stabbed and killed him and cut his wrist off and stole the money. That's the craziest story. Mm. That never happened.
That's like a straight out of a Quentin Tarantino movie. Or that was my favorite. That's my favorite, that he got his hand cut off for $2 million. Who carries $2 million around with him in a briefcase in the 60s?
And the handcuff himself in the briefcase.
I mean,
crazy story.
Ricky Dozan was a big superstar. Why would he do that? You know, why would he have? He could easily
none
have
of, none of that. None of that is true.
Yeah,
he
I
was
mean,
having
just
a good time at nightclub with his friends that night. That the entire schedule, you know, match schedule and all the event schedule is done. The previous night was six-man tag team with like the Valle and Buddy Austin, Ilio De Palo. He took train home and had a meeting with small people. And, you know, he was going to, you know, of all things, he was going to help small association to go to America and have a tour. And his new friend, Dick Bio, was going to help Sumo Association in the LA side and had a great meeting. Then moved to, he and his friend went to New Latin Quarter nightclub, famous nightclub, and was having a great time. Then there was a bar fight, of course. Then there was a sort of like not really like, what's the word? The stabbing itself wasn't all that crucial at the time.
Right. When you say stabbing, you imagine like the movie Psycho with somebody with a butcher knife in their hand and they're stabbing over and over. Where this sounds like, from the story that you told, a scuffle.
But it's well documented.
No. You know, what I'm saying is that it's a scuffle that this person that stabbed Riki Dozan, I think, you know, had a blade on him and he might have got, I don't know if he got stabbed quite intentionally or there was a kind of a poke and he might have severed something and he wasn't supposed to stab him in the right, you know what I mean, it wasn't an intentional murder.
Bar fight,
you know, it was more of a bar fight and less of a like a planned murder for money or something. Yeah.
And also Riki Dozan knew that person too, actually. There was like a 3 years back in 1960 he tried to stab Ricky Walder or somebody, that African wrestler in nightclub. I mean, wrestling fan, of course. Yeah, obviously, you know, the 22-year-old wrestling fan got in a fight with Ricky Walder and King Curtis Kerr, and he was going to stab Ricky Walder too. So this crazy fan was, his name was known. So Riki Dozan apparently recognized him in the bathroom, of course. Hmm. Yeah, and there was like you stop, you know, step my toe, and no, you step my toe, and this is like a little incident, and there was a bar fight, but there is not a videotaped or eyewitness on that, you know. But the guy stabbed him and ran, and Riki Dozan got up and walked, and came back to the table where he was drinking. He sat again and had more drinks. I said, nah, it's nothing, right? And so it wasn't all that like a really crucial, you know, that like not like you'd be dead there, you know what I'm saying?
Sure. He was a real tough guy about it. He didn't feel like it was a big deal. He got into a little scuffle. Yeah, there's some blood, but I'm gonna have a good time. It's kind
of And two sets of, you know, that the mafia Yakuza family came to Riki Dozan's home to apologize that night. And there was an incident that the actual person who stabbed him got real beaten up bad outside of the, you know, Riki Dozan's apartment and stuff. And there's like the dark side of that story too, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And all in all, that he had a surgery, in a major operation, you know, the following day. He was doing well. And the fifth day, it was like the newspaper reported that he'll be back in 2 months. You know what I'm saying? Mm-hmm. So it wasn't like he was going to die there.
It sounds like it was a shock, kind of.
Yeah. And there's a lot of stories that he started drinking water while he wasn't supposed to, or had somebody go get a, you know, bottle of 7-Up or Coca-Cola or something that he always wanted to drink. And there's the time that when he wasn't supposed to eat yet, he was eating. Or there's like a lot of stories that you just can't really prove right now. You know?
Yeah, there's. I think you might have told me the story about he might have been overeating right after he had gotten injured.
He got stabbed and it affected
his stomach.
Part of intestine. Yeah. Yeah. And also, there's the book written about that the doctor made medical mistake, you know. Yeah. And stuff like that. Mm-hmm. Mysterious things that happened 59 years ago. Now it's really, really like a bunch of pieces of puzzle that we still have to put together, and we still don't know the whole truth yet, you know.
Right, very controversial, seems a little bit conspiratorial, but it seems as years go on, the truth comes
But
out
it
more and
wasn't
more.
planned murder by
Right.
mafia or anything like that. It was, yeah,
It
like
wasn't a hit
it's,
by the
oh
hitman on,
no,
yeah, no, it's
no,
not as
just a very
dramatic.
low. Right. And he didn't want to die then. Yeah, just announced the Lakeside Country Club thing and the Ricky apartment and the Ricky Restaurant Cafe and the whole bit. And Ricky Palace was still there. That the Ricky Dozan's Ricky Palace Wrestling Building was actually sold, to third party only 3 years after Ricky Dozan passing. Oh, that all that the entrepreneur dream didn't really, come true. That all those things pretty much disappeared with Ricky Dozan, big, huge superstar Ricky Dozan disappearing from public. Yeah. So that was 1963, because he wanted to be part of this, 1964 Olympic, Tokyo Olympic. He donated 10 million yen in 1961, to, for JOC, Japan Olympic Committee and IOC, the National Olympic Committee. He even visited Rome Olympic in 1960. He wanted to be involved in the Olympic Committee. It symbolized that Japan's comeback and becoming a big, big economy. You know what I'm saying? The post-war era is over with. The Japan's on its move to be, to become good big company and country again, kind of thing. And it really was a, Riki Dozan really was a hero in that era.
Right, he was the symbol.
Yeah, of like a Japan making comeback kind of
Yeah,
thing and becoming.
the return to the stage.
Yeah. What was interesting that the fact he was from Korean Peninsula, for real, right? It was pretty well hidden that time period, for the 10-year Ricky Dozan superstar legacy. It was never talked about. That's why it was more secretive, more so than he wanted it to. He had to be Japanese hero, huh?
Yeah, because if he went the other way, it would have been a totally different story, wouldn't it?
Yeah, but he did visit Korea in 1962, and it wasn't even publicized. Yeah. He went to South Korea at that time in 1962 and met with a lot of famous, like an important politician that the day really, Korean people really, thought that Rick Dozan is one of them. And he was going to have a show in South Korea if he lived longer, Yeah. So a lot of things that it was planned that never took place. So we don't know about it, And the December of 1963, yeah, he died 59 years ago. And today's, as we're talking, it's December 22nd, right? That was the day Ricky Dozan had a famous single match against Masahiko Kimura, too. It was
Nice
December.
timing.
Yeah. And episode one, that was the night, December 15th was Ricky Dozan's Memorial Day. Yeah. A lot of people went to his gravesite that day. Yeah, 59 years later, there's a big statue of Ricky Dozan. Well, next time you're in Japan, let's go there together.
Yeah, I think it's a definitely a destination. It's in Tokyo. Big bust of his upper body. It's out in East
Yeah,
Tokyo, I think Nippori or
with
something.
this Luther's looking champion belt too.
Yeah, that's right. That's right.
Yeah, so it's very interesting. And also, Dick Beyer, the Destroyer, became the institution in Japan too. Yeah,
That's right.
and
He
ten yeah ten,
stayed.
10 years yeah 10 years later in 1973, and he stayed in Japan, lived in Japan with his family for a 7 year period full time, and his kids, all his kids, went to school and graduated from school, Japanese school, in Japan. And
Fluent Japanese speakers and
yeah, he still does business in Japan. And Dick Beyer, the Destroyer, was the very first person, American superstar wrestler, who signed full-time deal with Japanese company, with Giant Baba.
he also is one of the first wrestlers. I don't know if he was influenced by Riki Dozan because of this, but he also would open up his own golf course later on in his career in New York.
Yes, and Buffalo, New York. Oh, wow. I never thought of that. Yeah.
I don't. I mean, maybe he was an avid golfer from before. I know Destroyer was a really athletic, very
And yeah,
sports-centric
that college
personality.
wrestler and college
Gym
baseball
teacher.
player. Yeah, gym teacher. And even after retiring in 1993, that he kept coming back to Japan every summer with kids wrestling. When there was a big earthquake up north, he came over, came to volunteer, did the volunteer work and all these things. And he was always part of the, he was an institution, let's say, yeah, put it that way.
Yeah, and he'd be on television show, like non-wrestling television shows and
Yeah,
commercials.
in mid-70s, yeah, he was in Uwasa no Channel television. It's kind of like your Saturday Night Live type show, like a studio, sitcoms. And he was in commercial, of course. And this Christmas time, he had a Christmas album too.
That's
He was singing,
right.
yeah, like a vinyl LP.
Singing Japanese holiday songs too.
Yeah, he was. And also, he didn't age because of the mask.
The mask, that's
Yeah.
right. He was always the destroyer.
Yeah. Oh, he was wearing mask outside wrestling ring too. Wherever he went, he had that mask on. Yeah. So it's like, and see, Rikki Dozan's last big rival became Giant Baba's best friend. This is a great story.
Yeah, so I guess before we wrap up, I mean, his legacy, Rikki Dozan, his legacy, it extends farther than a lot of wrestlers. I mean, most wrestlers from Japan, but wrestlers all over the
Yeah,
world.
so there's a lot of ifs that if Rikki Dozan lived longer, what would Giant Baba and Antonio Inoki would do? Are they going to be New Japan Pro Wrestling? Are they going to be Old Japan Pro Wrestling? And every single spin-off from it. Yeah, now we have what, the over 100 wrestling group, companies out of Tokyo. It was going to be like that if Rikki Dozan lived. Maybe he had this, I don't know, the real association of wrestling companies, maybe. And or he would go on and become politician in Japan, much like Antonio Inoki did later on. Or be the ambassador for North Korea and South Korea.
You know,
I mean,
his how much is a lot of his family, they still live in Korea, or are they living in Japan these days, or
There's another mysterious part that he had kid, the daughter in Korea too, and he apparently he married in Japan about three times,
I see.
and yeah, two sons, two daughters, older daughter and younger daughter, and actually in 1963 he married to Keiko Tanaka, that the 21-year-old that the JAL that the flight attendant.
Spokesperson.
Yeah, and when Rikki Dozan passed, she was pregnant, so that the girl, her name is Hiromi, she was born after Rikki Dozan died. That's also Rikki Dozan's daughter. So there's like a one, two, three, four, at least five known children of Rikki Dozan. One in North Korea apparently, and the Yoshihiro, and yeah. So now Rikki Dozan's granddaughter and everything, but yes, that family, that tree is very complicated too with him.
But
Everything's pretty serious, huh?
he did have two sons that would continue on into the wrestling business.
Yes.
The Momota
Yeah, Momota
brothers.
brothers. Yeah.
And I think, is Mitsuo Momota still active as a wrestler?
Yeah, and his son Chikara, yes. Yeah,
He's
Mitsuo, yeah. And Pro Wrestling Noah he started with. Yeah. And Mitsuo Momota, youngest of Rikki Dozan's son, he's about 70 something, but he's not retired. He occasionally wrestles. Yoshihiro, the older brother of Mitsuo, Yoshihiro died 2001, probably. Yeah, he was part of Pro Wrestling Noah.
And he was a announcer and a wrestler.
Ring announcer with All Japan and also wrestler with All Japan Pro Wrestling. Yes.
And like you just said earlier, I work with his daughter, Remy-san. Yeah. She's also been with Noah for, I think, since early on.
Yeah, like 2 decades now, I guess. Mm. I guess, yeah. So the family is still here, yes.
It's still a part of the business. It always has been.
Yeah. And Ricky Dozan is the symbol of pro wrestling culture in Japan mm-hmm. to this day.
It starts with him.
Yeah, yes. Oh, he wasn't technically the first pro wrestler, Japanese pro wrestler. There was like people like your Sorakichi Matsuda like the end of the 19th century, and there's Taro Miyake or Mari Matsuda or people like that in 1920s and 30s. But post-war, beginning of television thing in Japan as a cultural icon, Ricky Dozan was the guy. Yes.
He was the hero. He was the national hero, superhero.
And books and books and books been written on him, and movies been made. Yeah. Mm-hmm. And we still see his footage in all over the place. And in the next year, 2023, will be 60th year since his passing. So a lot of things, that the books and movies and other things, picture book, all kinds of things are coming out this coming year.
Amazing. I mean, it's amazing. He was around for over a decade, but it's not
10 years in sumo wrestling and 12 years in professional wrestling, but it seemed a lot longer.
I mean, the impact feels like it would be longer, right?
Yeah. So, and everybody who was there remembers like the post-war modern Japan period that Ricky Dozan was your television star, the most famous person.
And people would just line up on the street to see him on these very tiny television screens if they didn't have them at their house.
Because TV set was really expensive in the early 50s, and it was like a post-war technology that you can watch movie at home. What's television, man, right? Mm. And people start buying TV set so you can watch Ricky Dozan, really.
It's very interesting. It's very important. And I think it helps if you're a fan of Japanese wrestling already. I think if you don't understand that piece of the puzzle, I think it will help illuminate everything.
Yeah. And then also Ricky Dozan was the one who discovered young Antonio Inoki and Giant Baba. Yeah.
Of course.
Two kings after Ricky Dozan.
Right. He's the first king.
Yeah. And there are two kings after that.
Mm-hmm. And the story continues.
And Antonio Inoki passing this year was really, big thing too. So.
Huge.
Yeah.
So I think we did a pretty decent job hitting everything. Yeah. But I think so.
I think it's impossible to cover everything because there's so much, But I wanted to correct some of the, like a stabbing incident in a myth go around with it,
That was a big one. As more podcasts and shows come out, there are people that tend to spin the truth or misrepresent or intentionally, unintentionally, who cares? It's just not right. It's incorrect. So thank you, Fumi, for setting the record straight.
Yeah, I'm still studying Ricky Dozan.
It seems like there's a lot to learn every day, so.
Yeah, There's more to it. And all these books are like 50 years old that I just discovering from old bookstore and what was written at the time, And it's really interesting to read old books, And it's another piece of puzzle that we can put together now.
Well, if we have questions or anybody out there has a comment or wants to ask you something, how can we reach you online?
On Twitter, at Fumihiko Dayo, FUMIHIKODAYO, Fumihiko Dayo on Twitter, or Fumisaito on Facebook. Please message me first, Ofrendia.
And on Twitter, I'm at Justin M. Nipper, KNIPPER. That's Ricky Dozan Parts 1 and 2, and that's it for now. I think this will be our final episode of the year. Next week, we'll send you an archived special bonus episode, but we'll come back with a new episode in January in 2023. So thanks everyone for joining us this year, and we'll see you next time. So until next year, Fumi, take us away.
So long from Tokyo.
Write that down, we say.